Today I awoke a day older than yesterday, and tomorrow I'll most likely add another one to that tally. Life is passing me by. I can go through my entire day's routine with my eyes closed. I'm bored, but stuck, and change is scary. It requires choice and uncertainty, and uncertainty is already an overabundance. The world is at war. Climate is changing, and not in a good way. Politics are dividing our country, all the while pandemics are paralyzing it with panic. So what's the purpose? Why am I here? What is the essence of existence? Any of this sound familiar? If so, well then, welcome to the wacky world of existential anxiety, an angst rooted in freedom, the freedom to choose. Yes, you have the freedom to flip the dial and find a safer station, or take a deep dive into a fulfilling discussion on dread. Well, for those still listening, welcome to the kooky side of crazy, an hour midweek during which we seek to take a lighthearted look at our lunacy. An hour during which we seek to reclaim the laughter that the lockdown stole away. An hour which is more than acceptable to not be all right. But also an hour of which you don't have to not be okay in isolation. Welcome to an hour when we destigmatize mental illness. And this evening's hour is exciting because I get to discuss one of my favorite topics with one of my favorite people. So stay tuned as my fellow Unitarian Universalist minister Russ Mink and I, Ryan Althaus, explore the essence of existential anxiety. This is the Kooky Side of Crazy, and you're listening to 90.7 The Squid. All right.
The kooky little coconut moved to the island. The kooky little coconut left the pretty palm tree. She built a little tiki hut down by the ocean, where the kooky little coconut raised her kooky family. And the kooky little coconut children played around in the sand. Two like to swim in the ocean, four like to dance on the land. Six played with the papayas that live by the ocean too. And every morning when the sun came up, they went to see the monkeys at the zoo. The kooky little coconut moved to the island. The kooky little coconut left the pretty palm tree. She built a little tiki hut.
All right, well, we are back, you guys, and you are listening to 90.7 FM. We are going to welcome Colin, so write down the number. It's 831-900-5773 if you have something to share, an idea, a thought, a question. But to start off, I want to introduce my fellow pastor over at the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Santa Cruz, Russ Mink.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you, Ryan, and thank you, K-Squid, for hosting such a cutting-edge show on the existential angst that we're wallowing in these days.
No doubt. So maybe we should start off a little bit by explaining to people what existential anxiety is. Because everybody's probably like, well, that's a big word. But in reality, this is something that we've all faced, well, our whole lives, probably. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, existential anxiety for me is rooted in the existential writers, etc. But it's all about the dilemma of choice, of the freedom to choose. And given that freedom we have to decide. But deciding on things can be anxiety-producing because did I make the right decision? What's the optimum decision? And this could be anything from what beer to buy versus what lifetime partner to choose.
Right? Yeah, no, there's a big weight to that. And choice is kind of scary. I personally, like, nothing gives me anxiety more than having to make a choice. I think one of the good ways that I've heard people describe existential anxiety in the past is to look at this phenomenon of vertigo. Mm-hmm. So most of our listeners have gotten close enough to a ledge that they've experienced this phenomenon of vertigo. So in that, the anxiety if it was coming from an existentialist, would not be the fear of falling, but the fear that you have the choice to jump.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's those decision-making. It's the choices that can be overwhelming. One of my favorite stories is from the Torah, and it goes back to a 14th century French priest called Buridan's Ass. And the parable is that if you have an ass in front of two piles of hay, equally distant from each other, equally nourishing, and the ass sits there and cannot make a decision because one is not better than the other, the ass ultimately dies of starvation. This is how paralyzing not making a decision, or the fear of making the wrong decision, or the fear of not making an optimum decision can be very detrimental.
Well, and the whole reason for the whole kooky side of crazy story, or the radio show in general, was basically because I looked at my own craziness, mm-hmm, and found, well, once I got over the trepidation of it, I found a lot of humor in it. Mm-hmm. And I've often wanted to write a book from the standpoint of my dog looking at me. And I think choice is one of the things I'll pace back and forth. And keep in mind, like, I live in a 14-foot little micro trailer. So this is a very short distance. But yeah, when I have to make a decision, I'll pace back and forth and back and forth and back and forth until I wear myself out enough that I just collapse and haven't made a choice.
One of the things I like so much about the title of this show, The Kooky Side of Crazy, is that it is a naming of the spectrum. Too often we think in binary terms. Mm-hmm. You're either happy, well-adjusted, or you're crazy and insane. And there's a whole spectrum of everything in between. And I think that's what you're always exploring with this program, Ryan, is to just, like, there's other side, you know, you don't have to be at one extreme or the other.
Yeah, and the other beauty of the program is it puts purpose to pain. And that's actually mm-hmm. one of the key things for existential anxiety, looking at how you kind of start recovering from it. So I've been deeply engulfed in Viktor Frankl's book lately. If any of you listeners have read it or haven't read it, you need to pick it up. But A Man's Search for Meaning. And it's looking at, like, how in the midst of a Holocaust concentration camp, somebody can actually, like, find purpose, find beauty. He looks at a flower at one point, and he just mm-hmm. stops, and that's it. That's there. So yeah, one of the points for this radio show is actually to put purpose to the pain, and that answers the question of existential anxiety, I think, the most, of, like, what is the purpose of life? You hear that a lot in kind of existentialist dialogue. What is the purpose? What is the... So it was funny. Russ and I were dialoguing on the phone before this and kind of sat, and it's like, I was anxious all week until all of a sudden we decided to do a radio show. And then my anxiety went away because the whole purpose of my anxiety is to put purpose to it. So as soon as I put purpose to it, calm as can be, and we are here today. So Russ, how did you get anxious driving into a show like this?
Yeah, I live with a large amount of anxiety, but I'm not avoiding it. I've grown to believe that anxiety is not something you need to get over. It is just mm-hmm. part of life. And as long as it's not debilitating or impacting me, or the pain is not so great it just takes me off into the dark side, anxiety is part of life. And so, yeah, I had anxiety. I mean, oh my gosh, you know, where is this place? Where am I going to park? What if I'm late? What if there's traffic? Oh my gosh, yeah.
Yeah, everything out of our control. It's super, yeah. It's always interesting to see what causes certain people anxiety, what doesn't cause people anxiety. Like myself, coming off an eating disorder, I can speak in front of 5,000 people on the fly, not bat an eye. Somebody puts a donut in front of me, and I start sweating. Comfort food sends me into crazy.
Mm.
So, but, oh, but an existentialist would say, like, anxiety's not bad.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's often the difference between, like, the definition of anxiety that, so the definition storybook of anxiety is a feeling of worry, nervousness, or unease, typically about an imminent event or something with an uncertain outcome.
And what triggers anxiety, as you've already mentioned, Ryan, is just as diverse as each one of us.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it is, I mean, what triggers me is probably different than you. I'm not triggered by donuts, but I respect your, you know, perception to be triggered. And just a little, because this is humorous in nature, you know what an unreasonable anxiety is? It's anything that I don't have.
I like that. No, it's so true, though.
We tend to be judgmental with this stuff, and that's to our collective pain and suffering.
Yeah, but karma does bite you in the butt. I remember when I was a kid, and she's probably listening right now. Hopefully, she better be listening, but my sister used to get panic attack on bridges. So I would just kind of joke, and yeah, I would be a jerk of a little brother. Because I never understood what a panic attack was up until 3 years ago when I had my first panic attack. I have so much empathy now. Like, I will personally carry her across any bridge she needs to go through from here on out.
Mm-hmm.
So.
What a rich metaphor. Anxiety of bridges, transitions, changes, going from one side to the other. That's metaphorically very rich.
It is. And the existential piece of that is, like, I guess existential anxiety oftentimes derives from when something you have faith in is put to doubt, put in question, taken away from you.
Mm.
And I think we all kind of have that. And that can be anything. That can be, like, your religion is all of a sudden questioned. It's just the little things. You're going to the grocery store is questioned when all of a sudden everything's shut down and everything's hard. So as soon as something stable, something you have faith in, gets shaken up, you all of a sudden realize that everything's out of control.
Mm. Oh, we so love certainty. Oh, my gosh. We're essentially addicted to it.
Oh, my gosh, you know, yeah.
When it's not there, we go into withdrawal, you know, when things are not certain. And, you know, the last 2 years have kind of shown us that there's not a lot of certainty to be counted on.
Yeah. And that's why I think a lot of times, like, I co-manage a sobriety home, and we're seeing, like, addiction rates going through the roof and the eating disorder rate, because that's what an eating disorder is. It's like a means of controlling via food. Like, the world's out of control. I know what it feels like to be full and hungry. I can control that. I'm going to grasp it. Or any number of things we go through. Like, I get really into routine. What mm-hmm. When you get anxious, do you have certain, like, steadfast things that give you that feeling of control back?
In part, I've been reading a lot of Stoicism.
All right, define that a little bit for us.
Pardon?
Define Stoicism.
Stoicism is a Greek philosophy from about 300 before the Common Era to about 300 after, and Christianity and the rise in that part of the world sort of eclipsed it and took it over. Stoicism is about, it's not the English use of the word stoic, meaning no expressing no feelings. It is really, down to a nutshell, it's Stoic philosophy says there's only two things you can control in life. One is your thoughts, and the other one is your actions.
Huh.
And your thoughts are also how you think about external events outside of your control. So the Stoics would say, okay, you know, I'm in prison and I'm being tortured. Whatever. It's kind of like, this is where I am. This is outside of my control. And it's up to me to decide how to think about that.
I like it. It's one, it's so interesting, too, because I guess when I had my eating disorder relapse and I was looking at doing the inpatient thing, the thing I wanted most was to have all that control. I funny enough, okay, so this just goes to show how kooky I really am. During those times, and we're still in that time right now, that, I mean, to get a counselor is like a 4-month wait. To get into an inpatient psych unit is upwards of like a 6-month to a year. So you've got these individuals where it's when you hit the point where you need to be inpatient, a day is like a century versus like a 6-month wait is. So I was going through trying to figure out what crime I could commit that was not serious enough that it would like impede my life in the future, but it was just serious enough to get me locked away so that I didn't have to be alone with myself for the near future.
Yeah, we crave structure, we crave certainty, and sometimes we have to shrink our circle so small to get a small semblance of something we can control. Some people get it through pets. You know, their pets are totally dependent on it, and I'm there for my pet, right?
Oh, 100%.
And so, you know, but that's something really, really small. The current situation, societal, that we're in is that it's overwhelming to think too far outside of your inner circle.
Oh my gosh, yeah.
Because it's so disturbing. It's there. And the Stoics would say, you can't control it. That's external, mm-hmm. but, you know, you can control your inner circle and your immediate contacts.
Yeah, and there's ways of doing it. And I think we subconsciously a lot of times limit ourselves so that we don't have to make the decisions. And I know I keep going back to the eating disorder thing, but that's just what I know. It's like there's a part of me that wants to be weak and fatigued, because then I can kind of fall back on that. I don't have to make as many choices. Like, I can tuck away. There's a part of people that actually does want to be almost imprisoned, because that restriction of freedom is just, it's comforting. Mm-hmm. So we do. We can self-limit ourselves without even knowing it and kind of sabotage our greater potential. Like, we sabotage our purpose in life, what we're actually searching, by limiting the choices, which, it's just an existential conundrum, really. We just go full circle and start spinning in there.
Mm-hmm. I listened to a TED Talk recently, and the presenter was saying how the title of the TED Talk is What Almost Dying Taught Me About Living. Mm. And the one moment that really pierced my heart was she said, meaning is what's left when everything else is stripped away. You know, she was in a hospital for almost 3 years, cancer treatment, all this stuff. Mm-hmm. Everything was stripped away. And yet it was the relationships that were really the core meaning. And that was with family, friends, and the staff, and the hospital staff. And that, again, meaning is what is left when everything else is stripped away. You know, you lose your car, your house, your stuff. It's just, what is meaning? It's kind of like, it's mm-hmm. that core.
And I think we so often look at the big picture and we're like, well, meaning of life. What's the meaning of life? But it's like, no, well, let's brush aside the meaning of life and let's go, what's the meaning of this moment?
Mm-hmm.
And be present in it. And that really is the meaning, is to be present. Like, that's the purpose in life, is to find presence. Just a reminder, you're listening to KSQD 90.7. This is the Kooky Side of Crazy. So you've got your happy two friendly Unitarian Universalist pastors, Russ Mink and Ryan Althaus, here chatting about existential anxiety. And once again, if you guys want to call in, it's 831-900-5773. So yeah, meaning. That's a hard one.
Well, it's beyond elusive. You know, it is something that can be a goal, something you move toward, but it's not, it's hardly ever anything that you can hold.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, and that was one of the tips of, like, cause there's different ways, there's institutes around existential anxiety of how to, and they don't say how to get over it. Cause once again, this is something of an existentialist would basically say, like, yes, you should be anxious. Life is short and it's ticking away. Like, it's not a bad thing, but anxiety is a door opener if you use it correctly. But what they're getting at when they start talking about ways to kind of like turn the table is they say to break down your life in terms of your values. Like, what, and that's just that. It's like, what in your life gives you meaning? Is it your family? Is it your, and then once you have those values aligned, figure out small things to address each one of them. So it's almost like action steps. Instead of looking at life as a whole, you go, my family is a value and gives me meaning right now. What can I do today to get closer to my family?
Well said, but you've got a whole society and a whole complex that's saying that's wrong.
Right.
You know, what gives you meaning is your Mercedes, is your
exactly.
house, is your LeBlanc pin, you know, the mm-hmm. the wristwatch. These are what meaning is. Because look at the ads. All these people are happy, right?
You know, yeah.
They're happy. They've achieved what you can't unless you buy, rent, you know,
uh-huh.
exotic. So you got quite a culture that you need to fight to get to what you're talking about, or what are my personal values.
Yeah, and I think what it comes down to, too, is like, okay, so we're looking at the basic first premise is like, we fear our freedom. We fear all these questions. We fear having to make a choice. Well, when you look at our society now, like, I don't even own a TV anymore because I can't handle the anxiety of flipping on and seeing the menu of, I mean, that's a full day's worth of creative energy just to pick what kind of TV show you want to watch at the end of the night. So I love Steve Jobs in the whole thing of, like, he used to have, like, two or three suits.
Mm-hmm.
And the same – because he realized he has a certain amount of energy to make choices during the day, and he doesn't want to waste it on sociological crap.
Yeah. The abundance that we're exposed to in our society, and I'll just say the inexpensive aspect of all these bling things,
mm-hmm.
It's the basis of a book. I'll misquote the title, but The Paradox of Choice. You know, it seems like if you have more choices – you could choose the optimum one, but it's a paradox because if you have the book talks about if you used to have one pair of jeans to buy, you know,
yep.
501 jeans, and you know they fit
there,
like they were terrible fitting, they were uncomfortable, but eventually they were tolerable. Now there's 100 different jeans, and you walk out of the store like did I buy the best ones?
Yeah,
are these as good as they used to be? I mean, you know, and so. This is really tough, the paradox of choice. We have too many choices to find to satisfy this anxiety to overcome it. Yeah.
Yeah, there was an example. It was actually on a TV show, and I forget which one. But the character was asked, like, do you want to use – he was presenting to a class. So he goes, do you want to use traditional pen and paper, or would you like to use a dry erase board? And he stopped, and he's like – I don't know. And all of a sudden he realized he goes, well, this would be easier. I need something to write with because I need to write down all the options and the pros and cons of each first. And he was stricken just then of, in order to do his diligence of the pros and cons of the main decision, he had to make a decision first.
Mm-hmm. And the ass starves to death.
Exactly. And we've come back to the ass. That dagon donkey will always render himself in. But it's, and that's where it really is comical. It's in our society, I think many people have heard of the whole FOMO thing. You familiar with this one, Russ?
It's an acronym, right?
Uh-huh. So FOMO stands for fear of missing out.
Mm.
And I think that's where it's, like, we're given so many choices nowadays, like the jeans. Like, okay, well, if I buy this pair, then, like, I'm missing out on how awesome my thighs are going to look in that pair, and I'm missing out on the comfort of that pair. And so we're always fearful of missing out on something.
Mm-hmm. And too many of our friends remind us of how wonderful their choices are.
Oh my gosh, yeah.
Sorry, all my friends. But, you know, we get input from other people saying, like, yeah, well, that's a good pair of jeans, uh-huh. but I really like mine. See this elastic waistband? This is really what I need.
And then we boast about it on the Facebook thing. It's like, and Russ just lost a whole bunch of Facebook friends. He got unfriended by a whole bunch of people. But no, it's just that. It's like, not only do I have to, like, deal with making the bad option, but it's going to be social media all over the place. Everybody's going to know I made the bad option. Mm-hmm. And I've got to look at other people who made the right option.
I'm trying to bring a saying up, and it's attributed to numerous people, but it's basically comparison is the enemy of joy.
Yeah, very much.
You know, and that can be our undermine our this quest for peace. You know, my goal is not happiness anymore. I just want peace. You know, enough to get
right?
through and balanced. And I'm okay with having some anxiety. I'm okay with having mm-hmm. sorrow. I'm okay with having some pain. Just, you know, can I just embrace it all?
Yeah, and that's a good question with our society right now. Is peace something we can actually find or strive for? So, yeah, that's a good one. What do you say? We're actually gonna, with that, like, since we're looking at what we're looking for, and maybe peace is that thing, let's take a few minutes. We're going to listen to U2's I Still Haven't Found What I'm Looking For. So listen to the lyrics of this, and as you guys are thinking through it, think of what it is that you're really looking for in your life. And we'll be back very shortly to dive deeper into this discussion on existential anxiety. So this is The Kooky Side of Crazy, and U2.
I am glad I
All right, you guys, so welcome back. This is Ryan. I'm sitting here with Russ Mink from the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship in Santa Cruz, and we are talking existential anxiety. So you're listening to The Kooky Side of Crazy on K-Squid. And yeah, if you all have a comment or question or just want to add to the conversation, feel free. It's 831-900-5773. And we left off with that, well, a little bit of an incentive to explore during that U2 song, what is it that you're looking for? So, Russ, I'm going to turn to you. What is it that you are looking for? You already kind of alluded to it.
Mm-hmm. There's never one answer. Mm-hmm. And so that's my guidance to people. It's like whatever you're looking for is temporary and it will be transient and you're going to have to adjust whenever you get close to it.
Yeah.
To make it personal, yeah, what am I looking for? Yeah, peace, contentment. I mean, in the existential sense, it's kind of like, yeah, I want to make a difference in the world. By right. touching other people. I do that through my service to other people. I'm basically committed the rest of my life to serving other people. And so mm-hmm. I'm trying to align my actions for the purpose of fulfilling my quest for meaning and search. And that is, I want to try and make the world a better place one person at a time.
Right. And I think 99.9% of our listeners would probably go with that. Have you ever read the book, The Five People You Meet in Heaven?
No.
It's Mitch Albom, and what happens basically is this guy dies. He was a carnival worker at a boardwalk, and just kind of, and they bring him in. So he goes up to heaven, and he's faced with the five people that most influenced his life. And I think like three out of the five, he didn't even know. Like it was almost a butterfly effect kind of thing. There was somebody that passed, but he was able to see how they changed his life. And I think that's part of the problem that we have right now in that. That's part of our existential angst is we focus, and I'm the guilty of, most guilty of this than anybody. Like we focus so much on how are we going to make that difference? How are we going to make how are we going to reach the most people that we neglect to see the impact that we have on that one person that we passed by on the street or the thing that we could have done for that? Like smiling at a homeless individual as you're walking by, that could be just the encouragement to give that person like that boost to push through one more night, to go to rehab, to go to a smile.
Absolutely. I mean, the challenge in our lives in trying to make a difference mm-hmm. is you never fully, probably will ever understand the difference you make.
Yeah.
Because it not only it ripples out, but it's that old saying about planting trees that I'll never be in the shade of, but someone else will.
Yes.
And so it is the seventh generation, you know, and I'm always encouraging people, like, become an ancestor.
Yeah.
Become an ancestor so that you are using your life value and your life energy for those who come after.
Mm-hmm. And an ancestor doesn't mean biological. It's like, become your legacy. But I think the real question there is, and that's where you start to make that transition a lot of times in life. And I'm actually going to hit you with the how you got into ministry question on this, because there's a point where your purpose is egotistical, and then there's a point where it evolves into a universal, a oneness. Like, I want society to be better. We're all one versus... Yeah, the early years of, a lot of people kind of live that way anyway. It's like, it's like, I want to be the biggest business. I want to be the big, and even in ministry, I want the biggest church. I want the biggest but you came into ministry from a business background.
I did. The short version is I was an aerospace engineer manager, middle and upper management for 30 years, making large solid propellant rocket motors in Utah. And then found the Unitarian Church in Salt Lake City about 2001, started going and was taken by it. You know, just like the whole message, the inclusivity, et cetera, became very involved with the church as a lay leader. And at one luncheon, one famous luncheon, the minister at the time, Tom Goldsmith, said, "Have you ever thought about becoming a minister? You have a strong calling."
And you're like,
And there was no hesitation. The answer is absolutely no. That's insane. That is totally crazy. I'm at the height of my career. I'm making good money. I love what I'm doing. No. But within a year and a half, my wife and I had sold our house, almost all our possessions, and moved into a 600-square-foot mobile home in San Leandro, California, so I could go to school in Berkeley, to theology school. But I want to get more into the – you hinted at a question of why. My ministry, and even my call to ministry, started out as an imitation of my home church minister.
Okay.
Great sermons, phenomenal sermons. And I'm sitting arrogantly in the pews going, like, I can do that.
Uh-huh.
I can do that.
And I can do it better.
And I can probably do it my way, which will be better.
It's always.
Competition, you know, the white male superior, you know, I can do this better. And it was years before that bubble was popped and the transformation, the transition to, no, I'm nothing more than a conduit for a message that's much greater than I am, for a spirit that's much greater than I am. And I am nothing but a pipe to try and get some of that energy, some of that love into the people.
That is, the best advice I ever received, and I've probably said it on this show before, is a Buddhist friend of mine just had at me, looks, and he goes, "You are not that important." And that can be just a real kick to your ego. Or if you're somebody that struggles with existential angst, that can actually be the most freeing statement ever of, like, wait a minute, I'm not that important. Like, the whole FOMO thing, the fear of missing out, that what I'm fearful of isn't that important. The genes aren't that important. It's a beautiful, beautiful gift when you start to realize, like, no, we're not that important. Life is finite. And, yeah.
I'm having a flashback to a service that you and I did at the Unitarian Church. And the question from the audience, it was a question and answer
service. Oh, I remember those. Yeah, those are fun.
A lot of fun. And one question was, how many people are in the world? And, you know, I'm an engineer, and so I say 7.6 billion people. And you answered one. And it just set me back. It's like, oh, there's a different way to look at this.
Right? It's we did a reflection the other day on Schadenfreude. So I think a lot of people are probably familiar with that. It's like wishing mal on upon another. It's kind of that misery loves company thing.
Yeah, taking joy in another person's misery.
And we all do it. I mean, we all do it. But it's just that. It's like, okay, well, if we're all one, then me wishing mal on you is really coming back. So if I could simply, like, make you a little bit happier, then I might be 7,500,000 so odd times happier myself.
Yeah. there's a huge transition that I believe is part of a spiritual evolution or growth, and moving from me to we.
Yeah.
It is key, I believe, in a real journey that takes you to meaning.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's probably why anxiety levels went so skyrocketed these past couple years, because, like, I mean, we were already on a downward trend. We're already in the iGeneration kind of thing, like iPhone, earphone, like you name it. But then the isolation thing kicks in, and it's like, yeah, all of a sudden it is just I again. That was super scary. Is super scary. It's still, I'm scared to be with myself all the time. Like, it's just
agreed. It's I'm thinking that the danger in being within yourself is if you're suffering an anxiety attack, if you're struggling with trying to deal with life, you can't think your way out of this.
Yeah, you can think your way deeper into it.
You can think, yeah, you can go a lot deeper. You can't read a book your way out of this.
Yeah.
You know, it is not something that you can do by yourself. And that, for me, that goes back to support group, community.
Because that's basically what existential anxiety is overthinking.
And we have evolved, you know, with the growth of our cerebral cortex in front. I mean, we've evolved to be future thinking people, you know, and it's a great benefit and it's also a great curse.
Yeah. Yeah, very much so. And that's, a lot of that, I think it was either Sartre or Heidegger, they both philosophers in the existential movement. I just lost my train of thought. How did I lose my train of thought on that one? That's embarrassing.
Are you suffering a bit of anxiety right now?
Now I am. You know, it's kind of, I wasn't until that.
And let's explore this, Ryan. Why are you anxious about this?
Because I have to prove that I'm smarter than my co-host right now. And I was naming, I was doing my name dropping and I had it all figured out. And I'll be darn if I didn't just slip.
You mean you're human?
I wouldn't go that far.
we're bantering this around, but humility is, and showing vulnerability is as key to spiritual growth as serving other people and getting away from me.
Oh, yeah. Well, it really is a means of serving other people.
Yeah.
Because when I show my faults, it allows you to show yours.
Yeah, and it's countercultural, you know, because, you know, we've been raised in this culture that the weak are the ones who cry, who, you know, show their emotions, who show their vulnerability, and et cetera. And so when faced with our own, we don't have a reference.
Yeah. No, it's so true. So true. That's why I actually love being a minister, though. It's like, being a construction worker, you can't cry. A minister, I can go around and hug people. I can cry. I can be a little bit. Yeah, it's just nobody's going to question that.
Let me ask you a question. So we'll start with a line from Hamlet, Act 2. There's nothing either good or bad, but thinking makes it so. What is the role of thinking in existential anxiety?
Gosh, I think therefore I am. It basically digs us deeper into our hole. Yeah, so what we were talking about earlier, it's just that it is the harder you think, and then you actually come to a point where you think about how to not think. So when you start overthinking about how not to overthink things, you're pretty much, you're done. Yep. You're spiraling. Somebody's got to pull you out in that scenario.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And there's ways to do that. My personal is to jump in cold water. And that's half the reason I moved to Santa Cruz, actually. When I get in my overthinking ruts and just start going through, like, I will leap into cold water. I've remembered what I was going at earlier. Okay, so it was Sartre that was talking about how to kind of escape these conditions. And basically what he was saying is like most of society just chooses to go with the flow. And you can turn off this anxiety if you choose, and it's a choice. Once again, we're going with choices.
Mm-hmm.
If you choose just to go with the standard, like, wake up, do my coffee, do my commute, go sit in a cubicle, come home. Like, yeah, it's routine is the essence. The routine is the best friend of a lazy mind, he said.
Mm-hmm.
So I always kind of liked that. But yeah, then you get faced with that choice of like, well, what if I don't want to? Have you read it? You've read A Brave New World.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So Aldous Huxley and. Mm-hmm. He's got, and it's basically a, how do you even describe it? It's like dystopian kind of.
Well, certainly a dystopia, but also it's normalizing behavior to the point of always almost controlling everything.
Yeah. And they've got their pills. They've got their
pills. You go to the movies for feelies because that's where you get your emotions. Is you put your hands on the thing and you feel what's being projected on this because you can't, you don't have the ability to feel anything yourself anymore.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's.
Yeah, and then you have that one individual, John the. Oh, he's John the something. And biblically, it just reminds me of like John the Baptist. He's going around eating locusts and talking, but he's like this wild one. And at the end, he's just like, yeah, he's standing in the storm and the light. Just give me, let me feel, let me pain.
I believe it's so important to reflect on the very questions we're bantering around tonight with some regularity.
Mm-hmm.
It's practice. And the practice of why am I here? What's the meaning? What has meaning for me? If you do that occasionally, irregularly, I don't know if you get the real depth to be able to give you the resilience to handle a real tragedy when it comes to your life.
But you might save yourself the pain in the moment,
right?
Because it can be pretty depressing and hard and. Mm-hmm. Yeah, most of these individuals that went through a transformation, and maybe that's another question too. And I had a big one too when I moved away from like a athletic lifestyle and that dynamic into like the Santa Cruz ministerial thing. Like I had a real depression. I lost my identity. So when you switched over from that business world into, oftentimes when you turn towards your calling, your purpose. It's not all daisies and daffodils. It can be a really depressing start.
Yeah, and there is no life without sorrow. There's no life without transitions and that sort of thing. And I'm having flashes of Henri Nouwen's book, The Wounded Healer.
Oh, yeah.
And the wounded healer is someone who knows pain. I may not know your pain, but I know pain. And I can be with you during your time of pain. And I don't understand what you're feeling, but I know there's deep pain. So, personally, yeah, there's been many transitions and many painful moments. And through the dark, through the depths of depression and anxiety, there has been those opportunities to come out and to say, wow, that was hell. Now what?
Right.
And it's starting over, you know. And again, I don't necessarily believe in the total myth of the hero's journey because I think it takes support group and community, you know, more than an individual push to get out of these things.
Yeah, no, it always takes community. And I think, too, we hit on the whole FOMO thing earlier, the fear of missing out. But I think what this kind of brings in is FOMO's distant cousin, FOBO. So when you've gone through enough kind of trials and whatnot, and you realize, okay, making these choices, making these changes is going to be hard. Like, I'm about to approach something difficult. You experience FOBO, which is fear of a better option.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, we know... I see this a lot in the recovery community that I work in. It's like, we know, okay, sobriety is a better option. Down the road, it's going to make me a happier person.
Yeah.
The withdrawal and what I'm about to go through when I approach it is pretty intense.
Yeah.
And reason being, and that's exactly what you alluded to earlier, is like, that's why... people go to support centers in order to make these better options, because making that better option is pretty daggone scary. Mm-hmm. That is the fear. That is the choice that we fear the most. But we don't have to do it alone.
And we can practice with support. We can practice reframing the whole decision thing.
Uh-huh.
You know, the whole thing of like, there is one best way to do things. I mean, there are zealots all around us telling us the best way to do things.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, everything from spiritually to, you know, what car to buy. You know, there's...
Oh, yeah.
And so we have to parse our way through that and come to terms with, oh, my gosh, this whole concept of good enough.
Mm-hmm.
Mm, challenging.
Yeah, it's... Well, and that's just that. It's in order for any of this to kind of like start moving forward and to move away from that fear of making choices a little bit, to start approaching that fear of a better option, to we've talked like in the beginning about how a lot of times existential anxiety occurs when what we have faith in is shaken. And I think what it comes down to in the upswing of that is, how do we get faith in ourselves that we have confidence that we will make a good choice?
First answer is I don't know. The second answer is practice.
Right?
Practice. And this is, by practicing, I mean you make decisions as best you can.
Uh-huh.
And then you think about it afterwards. You look at the consequences. You look at what happened. Not dwelling on what might have been, but like where you are.
Yeah.
And use it as a learning experience. I mean, if you don't fail at things,
uh-huh,
you're not going to advance. I mean, it's inevitable. I have a friend who talks about issues of social justice and the changes necessary in this world. And she's always advocating, let's fail ourselves forward.
Well, I like that. I like that. Someday that's a t-shirt waiting to happen.
Yeah.
Put that on the back of the t-shirts. People will chase you. Fail ourselves forward to... it's so rich.
I want to put in a plug.
Yeah.
For community. And because I believe community is essential in dealing with the ubiquitous existential anxiety that is everywhere around us. Bad behavior's up on all measures. Community. What uh-huh. is community? I believe it's important to have a safe community, a diverse community, and one that can give you different perspectives. Now, obviously, I'm very biased. You know, I'm a minister of a congregation. I believe that in order to practice a reflection of your existence and meaning, and to be in a safe community, I see a church as being a great place to start.
Oh, yeah.
But not just any church. It's a church that has to be your church.
Exactly.
And you can't just go to one church and say, no, that's not for me. Because there's a million different churches out there.
Yeah.
And so there are communities out there that are struggling with exactly what we're talking about. And they do it every week.
Oh, yeah. And that's the beauty of it. And you break down the word community, and what you have is common unity.
Mm.
And that's why it's so interesting, the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship, because there's not a common belief in one, like, I mean, you could have a Hindu, you could have a, you name it. But there's a common unity that you all find faith in something.
Right.
Yeah, it's just, and I like what it, I think it was Desmond Tutu that always kind of reinstated, is like, it's diversity or unity through diversity, not unity despite diversity.
That's good.
So, yeah. Well, golly, well, that went really fast. Yeah, to close this out, once again, yeah, you just listened to The Kooky Side of Crazy with Russ Mink of the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship here in Santa Cruz, and myself, Ryan Althaus, who bounces around a couple different congregations, speaking of community. And how do people find the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship? What's the website there?
I would just suggest people Google UU Santa Cruz. And it's UUFSCC.org, but we're out on Freedom Boulevard. We're beginning hybrid services in person and streaming. You can find us just Googling UU Santa Cruz.
Awesome, awesome. And, we're going to be doing something fun, actually, an outdoor service for the mm-hmm. Pride Parade coming up this year. So you'll hear more about that. We're actually, next show, we are going to look at mental health and Pride Month. So stay tuned, not this next Thursday, but the Thursday after that for a kickoff to Pride Month. And yeah, thanks for listening, y'all, to the Kooky Side of Crazy.
All right, thanks to both of you very much. Stay tuned in just a few minutes for Jazz Tracks with Michael Tanner.